Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bennington, Vermont. This talk, delivered on Sunday, April 14, 2024, is by Anthony Hughes on the topic of ethics and artificial intelligence.
Good morning. I'm Anthony Hughes. I must confess that I have given talks like this many times to audiences highly technical and completely non-technical, but I've never done so as part of a church service before. So this is a new and fun bit for me. I've spent my entire career in artificial intelligence, starting in graduate school, and never has it been so well known, such that people ask me constantly, "What is it all about?" I was having a medical procedure yesterday, just a diagnostic thing. And when the nurses found out what I did, I was grilled for 10 minutes based on whether autonomous driving really is a thing, what stock should I buy in some tech company. The answers are yes and NVIDIA. So it was. I get this all the time now. So I'm constantly explaining what AI is and how it's going to kill us all or maybe not, and I'm happy to do so here and afterwards. I can talk endlessly about these topics. And because of all these concerns about AI and me personally, I've gotten into what is called ethical AI starting about 6 to 7 years ago, before AI was as big a thing as it is today. But the knowledge in the public sector and the public mind and the news and so on about AI has been really exponentially growing for the last, I would say, 10 years. Before that, there wasn't really much awareness of it, a little bit, face recognition on your camera and detection and things like that. But mostly it's been a couple of breakthroughs I won't cover today, but there was something called the deep learning revolution, which made AI work a lot better, particularly in visual media, imagery and video, that made it commercially successful to use AI all over the place. And now we have large language models and AI almost everywhere, so everybody knows about it. And we have, of course, lots and lots of concerns. So I'm going to go over a couple of these things, but particularly with a focus on this ethical AI part, the risks of AI, and what we are doing about them, because there is actually a fair amount that's going on to try to really prevent AI from doing evil things and potentially ending humanity. It is possible. So existential threats are now real from AI. I'm not going to downplay that. I would not have said so 5 years ago, but those of us who spent their careers and are knowledgeable in AI now are much more alarmed than we were even 2 or 3 years ago about the potential for AI to be catastrophic. But there is much more going on to remediate that. So I'll focus here on a little bit about these issues. So first, what is AI? So AI is, there's a bunch of different definitions. Frankly, I just picked this one here. But generally, it's automating tasks, so doing things by computer control that previously only humans could really do. And it's typically then enumerated out, as you see here, visual perception, speech recognition, and so on. So mostly AI is computers getting smart and doing things that only people could do previously. And ironically, once computers are really good at doing something like that, we usually don't call it AI anymore. So AI is kind of this always evolving field where the forefront of the hard stuff that we're working on in the research world is still AI. But as soon as something works, then it doesn't really get called AI anymore, and you just kind of take it for granted. So what's happened over the last 20-odd years that enabled the current state of AI and technology today is called machine learning. Machine learning really started, well, before that, probably 30, 35 years ago. But in the previous century, that'd be the 20th century for those following along, the focus of AI was actually not machine learning. So we did a lot with geometry and a lot of what was called hand-coded rules. So machine learning wasn't really a thing. I mean, it was there, and it was emerging, certainly. Neural networks were emerging, too, which is the basis of AI today. But we did a lot of things by math. It was very mathematical in AI. And we didn't learn things as much. So there was some competition between the learning people and the what we call the structured people, the structured knowledge folks, or the model-based learning versus, say, learning model-based AI versus learning-based AI. But then machine learning kind of took over the world because we had a lot more data and a lot more compute power and things like that. So machine learning is now this dominant part of AI. There's still some bits that are not learning-based, but mostly it's learning that drives everything. So machine learning is learning by example. So you give the computer a set of data and examples on the data for what you want it to do. For example, to teach a computer how to recognize an object these days, you just have to give it a bunch of examples of the object in an image. So you have an image, you say this image shows a cat or a giraffe or a car of a particular make and model and so on. And you just give it a bunch of examples that show all the variation in appearance that that object might have typically. So different viewpoints, different sizes of the object, different lighting conditions, things like that. And you just give it a set of these examples, and then the computer, the AI model in there will learn how to recognize it on images that it has not seen before. So it can generalize from those examples to a more robust capability and recognize the same thing in different scenes, in different poses, and so on. So that's a learning-based method. And what's neat about that is you didn't ever tell the computer that a cat has four legs and fur and little ears and that it's cute. You know, you didn't have to tell it any of those things. You just give it examples. So most of machine learning works this way. So you just give it a bunch of examples, and you tell it what is interesting in the image. You give it this label, cat or car or whatever, and then it learns how to recognize those things. So that's machine learning. And there's a whole range of machine learning methods. A couple of them are portrayed here, decision trees on the left, support vector machine on the right. So our community has spent decades and literally thousands and thousands of dissertations at top technical schools figuring out how to do machine learning in one way or another. So neither of these methods that I show on the page here is what we really do that much of today. These are things that were developed in the 90s, actually, and then used through the 2010s. But neural networks started to take over the world. And that's generally called deep learning. So neural networks were invented probably in the 70s. So they've been around forever. And a neural network is a machine learning model. So it learns from examples and data. But it's modeled after the human neuron, a single neuron in your brain, and a very simple function, just a simple weighted sum. I should ask, by the way, how many of you in the audience have a technical degree or a technical background of some sort? Oh, good. I'm going to focus my talk on that guy. Okay. So a neural network is shown here in the upper part. And it really is very, very simple. It's just a bunch of weighted sums and then a little decision function. And all that means is that these nodes here, they're mimicking very, very coarsely the function of neurons in, say, the human brain, or actually other animals, too. So our neurons are actually not really any different than other mammals, for example. And the way neurons typically work is each one of these circles here is a neuron. And one neuron, good, you can see my pointer. So one neuron here gets inputs from these other neurons, so these arrows are going from here to, say, there. And each one of those inputs is actually just a number between 0 and 1. And this neuron adds up those numbers, and if they're above a threshold, then this neuron says, I'm going to turn on and I'm going to send my own number down to these other neurons, the next layer that I'm connected to. So it sends the same number this way and the same number that way. So this is a very, very simple, basic emulation of how our brains actually work. It's very simple because here in the networks that we have, the neurons aren't very connected to other things. The activation function is simple. Our brains are actually much more complicated than this, these neurons. Even a single neuron can often have a connection to hundreds or thousands of other neurons. They don't work on this simple activation function. There's a temporal synchrony thing that goes on. So people didn't think in the computer science world even that this would amount to much because it's so simple, right? It is emulating the brain, but when you get to a certain level of simplicity, well, maybe you just really never be able to do anything like the computation the brain can do. So neural networks were, they've gone through at least two or three different interesting phases of excitement. And initially, back in the 70s, when some basic models first came around like this, people were excited about them. And that was when it was very difficult to program anything. You know, computers were relatively tiny. But then a famous paper was written, which theoretically showed that little networks like this couldn't solve certain basic functions, and so people lost interest. But a couple of people persisted and continued to do neural network stuff through the 90s and then through the 2010s, and they were the pariahs of the research community, right? They couldn't get their papers published. They were moderately embittered. They felt like their work wasn't appreciated at all. But then they had a breakthrough in 2011 and then 2012, where they had some big neural networks solved problems much better than other methods could do. So people really took interest, and then the whole deep learning revolution very quickly followed. So now all these methods we're using, large language models, ChatGPT, autonomous driving, recognizing people from your car, all those things, little smartphone functions about Snapchat, putting things on your face, all that stuff, a lot of it, not all of it, is using some structure like this little thing right here, except that there's not 8 or 10 nodes. There's 100 million nodes, right? And those arrows, there's probably 500 million arrows, right? Or even billions of nodes. And that scale is what gives it intelligence. So you scale it up that much, and suddenly this model can remember many things and know many things and do many things, even more than was expected. So that's called emergent behavior, when you build a model and then it does more than you expected because you didn't program it to, but it's doing that somehow anyway. And when you get up to really, really large models like this, this emergent behavior has shown up. It literally has emerged. And ChatGPT and these big models are doing a lot more than even their designers ever expected. That's not to say they're out of control. So they're not doing things on their own or saying, kill all humans. But they are doing things that it was not expected. So this is what's called a Venn diagram. You might remember this from high school math if you ever did that. It just means it's just a set theory thing. It just means each circle here is a type of a class of AI in this case. So in the world of AI here, so this part here, we have these different components within AI, and we talked about machine learning, and then deep learning is a subset of machine learning. Right? So deep learning is completely inside machine learning because it's one type of machine learning. But as we talked about, deep learning is not the only type of machine learning. There's other things too. And then computer vision, my main area, is this one here. And notice that computer vision overlaps with machine learning and deep learning too. So a ton of computer vision uses machine learning. Not all of it, though. There's some parts of vision out here, outside the machine learning bubble. And what's happened over the last 20 years is that the overlap between computer vision and machine learning has greatly increased. It used to be zero, and then it was a little bit, and now it's more and more and more. And so now basically everything, almost any algorithm you're going to write in computer vision is going to use some kind of machine learning. So the overlap is almost complete in the vision side. And then there's a bunch of machine learning stuff that doesn't actually use computer vision, because vision is about images and video, visual data. But if you're doing text data or something else, predicting the stock market and so on, then you're not using computer vision, although a lot of the underlying techniques are similar. I have medical imaging on here too. And then there's areas like robotics, that's where autonomous driving lives, where there's a whole lot of stuff that's not AI, right? So how do you build a control system? How do you wire things together? There's a whole lot of physical components there and electronics, stuff like that. But then there's a whole lot of AI in robotics too. So how do you make a robot balance itself and walk like a human? That's certainly in the level of autonomy that's considered AI. And then autonomous driving, same thing. And lately, what's gotten everybody so excited is natural language processing. So this is processing text and speech, things like that. And natural language processing has existed just about as long as AI. It's always been one of the foundational areas, just like computer vision. But now, it really emerged because these large language models came out. Right? And that's part of natural language processing. So a large language model is ChatGPT and all these other similar ones that you can use from the other internet companies like Google. There's also what's called an LPTM, large pre-trained model. That is a large language model that has other modalities in it, like images and video. So now that images and video are added in, you can do interaction. You can generate images. You can ask the computer to interpret what is an image in an image, put images and text together. So those kinds of multimodal models are dominant now. And the latest ChatGPT model, for example, has imagery in it. So it knows how to understand images. You can put an image in as a query and ask the machine things about the image. Okay. So today, LLMs are used in a variety of ways, some of which I'm sure you're very familiar with. There's the basic user interface. You log in, you can interact with it. You can have it write text for you. You can give it text, and it'll clean up the text and make it better. You can literally say, you know, rewrite this paragraph in better English or something like that, and it works. I see that a lot, actually, because in my world, I do a ton of reviewing for research conferences, and the vast majority of people who do computer vision are not native English speakers. So they, and often, and for my entire career, I've always had to just plow my way through paper after paper that was written in almost unintelligible English, and just literally broken English. That all stopped about a year ago, because we allow our authors, people who submit papers, to use a large language model, not to write the paper, but to clean it up. So everybody does. So now most of our papers are actually written by these LLMs, right? So you give it a rough draft, and what, you know, all the ideas and everything is there, but then you say, clean this up. And so now we don't have broken English anymore. Now we have large language model English, which is very recognizable too, but it's also legible, or you can actually understand it. You know, it's actually well written, but it is very stylistically different. So another big area, which is actually very impactful, is writing source code. So this is kind of behind the scenes, but for developers and so on, these large language models have been given source code, so programming, and they can do it, right? So you can literally, in English text, you can say, write me a code function to do this, right? To add 16 numbers, these 16 numbers together and take their square root and then put it in this database table. You can actually just specify that out just as I said it, and you will get a respectable bit of code back out of these large language models. It might not be quite right. It might be a little bit wrong, but often it's close enough, and often it isn't. It isn't wrong at all. It's perfectly works. It's compilable. Then there's another part of this, retrieval augmented generation, which is a huge thing in the business world, where you can combine an LLM plus an existing database. You take a database, you put an LLM on top of it, and then you can ask it just normal text questions, and you'll get back data from this database. And there's constraints, so the LLM won't actually lie. It won't lie to you. So a big issue with large language models is they make stuff up, right, and it sounds perfectly reasonable, but it's wrong. Right? And that's because the way these models are built, there's really no fact-checking that's possible with these models inherently. There's post-processes and things like that that the makers of these models are putting in there, but they still don't work very well. So this process here is guaranteed not to mess up your data. So it pulls it out of the database and doesn't change it, but it presents to you nicely. So as you probably know, the multimodal side, image generation by a text, so you can type in text like this into a system called DALL-E or Stable Diffusion, and then it produces an image like that. You can give it images and get captions out. So the system will understand the image and tell you what's in it. They're pretty tiny. So on the left here, the prompt here is modern office with computers in the foreground, coffee machine in the background with blue and green walls. Right. So, and that's something of a description of my office at Kitware. You'll notice the blue and green logo here. Those are our colors. So I produced this, which looks pretty much nothing like Kitware, but it's a pretty good rendition of what the words were. And then image captioning here. This one here, a little girl eating a slice of watermelon. This one, a dragonfly sitting on top of a computer. So these are real images, not generated ones. But they were given to the computer and said, tell me what's in the image. Basically write a caption for this image. And the computer is doing that. A woman standing on a beach holding a surfboard. And then question and answering. You can ask the computer questions about the image. Question, what are they holding? Answer, a cake with a picture of a woman on it, which is correct. All right, so as Bruce mentioned, I've been doing AI my entire career. And I started out as an undergrad in computer science, and back then, especially at a little school like Amherst College, there were only 1,600 students, there was no artificial intelligence course until my third year. And then we did hire a professor who had an AI background, started an AI course, and I was interested in AI, so I took his course, and I said, oh, this stuff is great. So I decided to go to grad school for that, went to Illinois for a couple of years and did a master's, and then went over to Penn and did a PhD in computer vision. So counting school time, I've been doing computer vision since about 1990 or so. Computer vision, remember, is one of those big parts of AI. After my PhD, I joined GE Research, which is what brought me to this general area in Schenectady. So Bethany and I moved together up to GE Research and worked there in different groups. She was in a software group, and I was in this computer vision group. I left there in 2007 to start a computer vision group at this little company of just 30 employees at the time that did a lot of federal contracting called Kitware. They were based in scientific visualization, a little bit of medical image analysis, and I started a computer vision team there. And then in about 2018, I got into ethical AI, which I'll talk a little bit more about later. I can share these slides, by the way. I shared a link with Bruce, and anyone who wants to see these slides can have them. Obviously, they're fully publicly releasable. No proprietary or classified stuff in here, obviously. We do a lot of stuff for the government. So this is from, not my work, but this is from the Pew Charitable Trust study that was done in August. And things will probably be a little worse today if this were done right now. But they were polled normal people, right? So attempting to be a representative slice of the population in the U.S., you know, concern about AI in daily life far outweighs excitement. That's what this says here. So concerns have gotten worse compared to excitement. And these are years here, 21, 22, and 23. So we're looking at this every August of these years, right? And concern is the bottom one here in green. And concern has risen from 37% to 52% over the last 2 years. That's a big increase. And more excited than concern started out as 18% and has shrunk to 10%, and about equal 45% to 36%. So the proportion of people who are more concerned has gone way up, and the other ones have certainly shrunk. So lots more concern amongst the population in the U.S. This one here, Americans have a negative view of AI's impact on privacy, more positive towards impact in other areas. And then there's an enumeration here of different things that AI can do. And hurts more than it helps is on the left side here in green, and helps more than it hurts is on the blue. So people feel positive about AI if there's more blue over here than green over here. So very negative on this second one here. This is people keeping their personal information private. So the whole privacy issue in AI, 53% say AI hurts more than it helps. Only 10% say AI helps more than it hurts. So this is wrong. I'm just going to put that out there. So AI actually does help enormously with privacy, but the ecosystem of AI and companies' motivations to grab your data and stuff it into their AI really hurts privacy, right? So the AI technology itself is actually capable of doing wonderful things with privacy. It's the way it's used, like anything, right? The tool is misused and abused, and there's many, many motivations for companies to get as much data as possible and make the models bigger and bigger and bigger because of that emergence I talked about. The more size you have in your model, the more data you put in there, the smarter it is. And the better it is, the more money you're going to make selling its services to people. So they want to get all the data. Not just some of the data. They want all the data. So the entire internet, you know, being stuffed into these models, violating copyrights, privacy, et cetera, that's all happening. And certainly the AI ecosystem is to blame for that, but the AI technology itself isn't really responsible. And AI does enable actually really good forms of privacy. Self-driving cars. So companies making safe cars and trucks, 37% say AI helps more than it hurts. That's good. And if you have a vehicle in the last 5 years or so that's new, you probably have all kinds of nice features in there that you make you more safe, like detecting someone in your blind spot and lane following, right, staying centered in your lane. These are all autonomy types of functions, and they use like sort of low-level forms of AI, right? They don't use these huge LLM-type models, but there is AI there, and it is computer vision. There's a camera looking forward from your dashboard and all around you to detect other vehicles and pedestrians and cars in front of you. There's other sensors too. They're all being fused together. So the autonomous driving world has actually been fueling AI growth and computer vision growth enormously over the last 10 years or so. It's actually the biggest single industry that sponsors computer vision work, even much more so than, say, internet data. Doctors providing quality care. So AI is a lot better than doctors now diagnostically in many, many situations. This has been shown again and again and again. So diagnosing cancer in various forms of imaging Radiologists, forever, it's really been known that they're notoriously inconsistent. If you give an X-ray or a CT scan to multiple radiologists, they will come up with significantly different ratings of the likelihood of cancer for a particular suspicious part of that image. The algorithm is going to be consistent, but it turns out the algorithms now are actually much better than even a consensus of radiologists on many, many problems. And I think people are starting to appreciate that. People taking care of their health and so on. So it's a good balance. Police maintaining public safety, it's about an even split. So, you know, interesting study, lots of stuff to unpack there. And then this one, Americans are concerned about AI systems that could know people's thoughts and make important life decisions for them. So this is one thing that I work on quite a bit, AI making life and death decisions. In my team, we also work on AI that can potentially kill people. That's happening. And how do we control that? What do we do about that? Because we are doing it as a society, as a world. So the question is, how do we do that properly? So performing household chores, this is somewhat excited versus concerned again. So a lot of people, household chores, I got my Roomba, right, my little vacuum, it's going around. That's good. Repetitive workplace tasks, that's a positive. And then down at the bottom here, make important life decisions for people. Only 9% are excited about that, 74% are not. Know people's thoughts and behavior is about the same. And at a conference recently, we had about 800 or 900 people at this particular academic conference. I was running a plenary session, so kind of like this, but there were 900 of you, and you all had PhDs in computer vision. And I asked the audience, I said, so do you believe that AI should be more regulated than it has been, right? That there should be laws and rules about keeping AI safe? And about 75% of the audience said no. I was surprised, actually. Disappointed, of course, but I was quite surprised. Yep. And in particular, the rules and regulations I was talking about there is the recent Biden administration ruling, which I'll get to if I have a little bit of time. But okay, so the risks of AI. So what is all this potentially leading to? Malicious use is first and foremost on the list. Now, this list here isn't my list. This comes from the Center for AI Safety, which is a big AI safety regulation organization, a nonprofit thing, the link on the bottom there. So malicious use. So armed autonomy without appropriate controls can be obviously very bad. Weaponized disinformation is going on like crazy. So disinformation is bad enough, right? People just distorting messages, making up lies, making it look like truth, you know, doctoring imagery and video and things like that. Before that required, even like 3 or 4 years ago, that required a person really be doing that. But now AI can do that really well. And so you can do it at scale. So now you can do disinformation attacks on a much broader basis, reaching into much finer grained levels of society and different groups of people with very targeted messages. So that's a huge problem. And then we haven't seen too much of it yet, and it's not that well publicized, but one of the biggest risks here is actually AI cyber attacks. So an AI that can do cyber attacks really well is extremely hard to defend because it can operate very quickly. And probably only an AI could defend against that. So in the technical world, this is probably one of the biggest risks. AI arms race. So what's happening in the world is the U.S. versus China in AI. China is doing nothing about regulating AI, quite the opposite. But China is huge in AI. They've made an enormous national investment, much greater than ours, over the last 10 years. And they're not shy about this, right? They're stating it publicly. We're going to take over the world. We're going to do it with AI. They flood our universities with grad students, and our universities are happy to accept this. So at a typical lab in computer vision or AI, machine learning, anything like that, you go to RPI, you go to any of these schools around, it's 90% Chinese students, 90%. And it has been for 15, 20 years. That's actually, the past couple of years, that's decreased a little bit because of the tensions between China and the U.S. They're worried about getting visas and going home and things like that. But China is emphasizing this much more than we are. And it's 90% Chinese students, not because the universities are desperate to attract Chinese students, right? It's because Americans just don't apply. Or Americans just don't go to grad school in computer science. And that's the issue. There's very, very few of us, meaning like American citizens born in the U.S. I face this all the time with hiring. I want to hire U.S. citizens because we do a lot of government work and we have restrictions on who we can fund. And our applicant pool, it's hard to say, but it's probably 95% foreign nationals, and most of those are Chinese. There's a variety of others from India, South Asia is big, Israel, things like that. But very, very few U.S. citizens in the applicant pool for AI researchers. Organizational risks, you hear a lot about unintended bias, anticipated outcomes, people prioritizing companies. They're going to prioritize profits. It's just what companies do, what they're supposed to do. You have to have government regulation to maintain any kind of balance there. We're finally seeing some of that. And then my favorite one, in the sense that I think it's the most likely to be a huge problem, is the rogue AI issue. Because you can make an AI that gets out of control on the internet. Like if you build an AI that was just to distort internet traffic, right, to just slow everything down, it might be irrevocable. I mean, you might not be able to actually get rid of it once it's out there on the web. And it wouldn't be that hard to do such a thing, and there's so many bad actors out there, like North Korea, terrorist groups that are capable of potentially doing this, that this is a huge risk, having a rogue AI that's just going to make things difficult. All right, so what are we doing all this? So ethical AI is trying to make AI ethical. So literally the same ethics we have, the same values, in this case Western cultural values, how do we get those into an AI? Can we do that? And the answer is yes, we can actually program AIs to be ethical. And the leader on this in the U.S. is the Department of Defense. So believe it or not, the DOD published these 5 ethical AI principles in February of 2020, after a couple of years of research on it, and has been leading the charge on the government side in building AI that is ethical. I do most of my work for the DOD, and so this has been a focus of ours. It's been a great, you know, a great emphasis in explainable AI to reduce bias, things like that, make it governable so you can shut it off. So there's a ton of work going on here. This is a map of all the different ethical AI standards and principles that are out there internationally. There's dozens and dozens of them. European Union, even China and Russia have them. They just don't follow them, just like their constitutions, right? They look great, but they ignore them. In our own country, the Biden administration has been fantastic for this. So if you want to regulate AI, vote for Biden. I'm not going to say anything else. he's put out this big regulation issue on the 30th of October saying if you build a large model, you've got to tell the government you did it, and you've got to say how you tested it and how you assure what kind of assurance you have that you can validate that it will not cause societal harm. The NIST AI risk management framework, also funded by the administration, they said, what do you got to understand the risks of AI and how we can build systems that have less risk. And then recently they started up, the Biden administration started up this AI Safety Institute. And there's a consortium of companies that can voluntarily join. There's about 200 companies and universities. My company joined, this started up in January. So there's a lot of work going on in safety and regulation. There's a lot of ways to make AI safe. It's just a question of doing it. And it costs money to do that. It might make the AI less performant. That's why regulation is required. Right? The market is not going to solve this on its own. That's already been demonstrated. There is a lot of political backlash when Google, you know, misrecognizes people as animals and things like that. Those are well-known cases. But behind the scenes, there is just way too much money to be had. And companies are already very much pushing the envelope. There's rafts of lawsuits. So the law is catching up with it. But counting on the law to get ahead of this is a very risky proposition because the law is always a lagging indicator, right? So you have to go through the courts, and it takes years before the legal system in a lawsuit sense will sort it out. And by then, it may be too late. Okay, so I'll skip over what we're doing at my company to do this, but rest assured that we have a lot of stuff that's happening to combat all these difficulties in AI. Right, the U.S. is leading the charge here. We brought in the EU and the U.K. in particular. There was a big conference just a couple months ago on this where we all signed on to regulate AI and not let it get out of control. We are working on armed autonomy, so that is a fact. There's been armed autonomy for over a century. Making it ethical is very possible, and my company, through Department of Defense funding, is one of the leading research organizations looking at that problem. So how do you minimize collateral damage? How do you get ethics into AI on the battlefield? Because AI is already on the battlefield. It's not really a question of whether there is going to be AI there, whether AI is going to be controlling weapons. It already is in the U.S. as well as other countries. It's already being misused by the Russians, So the question is, how do we make it behave according to our own laws of war, rules of engagement, and the ethics of our Western culture?